This is a download from BFM 89.9, the business station.
BFM 89.9, Kusu Chuang and myself, Sharad Kutin, starting you off. First thing this morning, it is the 24th of October. It's a Tuesday, just in case you need to check on that. And we're taking you all the way up to 10 o'clock this morning with a range of discussions and interviews that will curl your toes. Don't you agree, Chuang?
My toes have curled already. They're in the present tense.
Oh, dear, dear, dear. Okay, now just a quick rundown on some stories that you might have missed the end of the news cycle yesterday that still relevant today. The Deputy Prime Minister, Zahid Hamidi, says there's no case against businessman Joe Loh and that Interpol is not seeking Loh at the behest of the Malaysian government. The police case against him in Malaysia is closed. Now, Malaysia Kini also reported Loh's yacht Equanimity is docked in Sabang, a town in Pulawayo in Aceh, very recently. Now, just to remind you, the U.S. Department of Justice is seeking Equanimity as part of the 1MDB-related assets they believe was funded by laundered money. So the U.S. Department of Justice believes that 1MDB paid, or monies from 1MDB paid for Equanimity. But back in Malaysia, we don't obviously share the same view.
Yeah, you know, your view might be tempered somewhat by the 300-foot yacht that has 9 staterooms and 26 guests and a crew of 28.
You haven't been on, have you?
I have not been
on.
You have
such intimate details of the interiors.
I've not been on the lists, unfortunately. <You're> not,
but he's a fellow Penangite, is he not?
Yes, he is, yeah. And
did I note some pride in the voice?
Actually, you're right. A bit like, you know.
A bit like, yeah. Right. Oh, my goodness. Okay. Two past leaders are supporting preacher Zakir Naik, even as the preacher faces an imminent bid by New Delhi to seek extradition on terrorism-related charges. So, anti-terror unit in the Indian government believes it has a case against Zakir Naik in terms of funding terror activities. And yet, there are Malaysians. Remember when Zakir Naik first came, he was feted like a king. In fact, I believe there were even offers of islands made to Zakir Naik to place or to locate a research institute. I don't know what's happened to that proposal, but there it was, as an outpouring of love for the Indian preacher who now faces terrorism charges in India. Because the past leaders believe that the charges against him, allegations against him, are just an attempt by the New Delhi government to curb Muslims and Islamic-related activities in India. Also in the news, Sabahan Mohammad Amin Bako is believed to be among the 42 dead in the last stand between terrorists and troops in Marawi City in the Philippines yesterday.
Lots of stuff happening around the world, isn't there?
Lots of stuff, and we're going to keep you updated on that stuff, as you call it, Chuang. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Crimson and Clover by Tommy James and the Shondells.
The Shondells, I love that name. So 70s, isn't it? So Motown.
It is indeed. What was not big news in the 70s, of course, was the
internet, social media.
Yeah, I mean, definitely no internet and the social media that rides on that platform, but also the phenomena of fake news. I mean, just recently over the Spanish debacle in Catalonia, the Spanish foreign minister apparently came out and said that images and video of police attacking Catalonian voters was fake news. Everybody uses that accusation these days.
Yeah, most notably the POTUS, yeah, Mr. Trump himself. But I'm not sure it's a double-edged sword here because, I mean, the New York Times is running a story saying that what you read on social media sometimes can be conjured into fact and people are taking that as gospel when it shouldn't be the case. But you can't tell who's telling the truth nowadays. You've got social media influencers, you've got people's professional writers producing stuff, which is pretty good editorialism, pretty good journalism, or what appears to be on behalf of brands and manufacturers and politicians and leaders. But this is journalism's new dawn, isn't it? It's journalism's new awakening. Because from here, you'll get to some settling point in time in the future, and then you'll have credibility rear its beautiful head once again.
Well, I mean, that's a kind of hopeful image of the world. I mean, I do think that in the, you know, with the waning of the influence of experts, we have a real problem, because in the past we would defer to experts, people who spend time, specialists and such. But today I think the ethos is that everybody has a right to an opinion, whether it's informed or not, whether it's backed by deep consideration and research. All that is, you know, really... you know, I think part of the problem, and we just don't trust anybody. We only trust ourselves.
Sure.
We might not be the best people to make decisions and things.
I don't think the mainstream media or the establishment media, as we knew it then, okay, because, like, for example, in the UK where I used to study, right, the newspapers there used to have far-right leanings, far-left leanings, centrist leanings, and they used to be owned by... people, right? For example, with political affiliations. I mean, much was made of who owned the Daily Mail, who owns Fox News, who owns News to the World, who owns now the Sunday Times and the Times of London, Rupert Murdoch, and I think the Daily Mail guy as well. I mean, all of them had political leanings.
And everybody knew. It was kind of transparent.
Yeah, so the stories that they produced and the information that they produced and the op-eds and the columns and the opinions that they produced always had a certain leaning. Do you know what I mean? So
leanings are fine, because once if somebody's a transparent, like, you know, we talk every day about politics and we each know each other's leanings. So, you know, that you factor that into your discussions and
what's
your assessment
of things.
How different
is the internet then? How different is social media then? Because everything is a certain grain of truth or a certain news hook to get into the leaning. But what's different? Nothing much, really.
Well, yeah, that's. I think it's a difference in kind of the speed at which things are traveling and information, and also the demands on us to respond. So with social media, it's not something, you know, you have the on one end of the spectrum, kind of benign like. You can like things, but also you can comment, and that comment spurs and its own sort of dynamics, right? So there's a lot of hate on social media platforms, and that comes from watching a video or looking at an image. And I've seen, say, for instance, this image of these kids, these young little kids, having their hands out on a road, and somebody looks like he's going to ride a motorcycle across the fingers of these young kids. So it's a kind of an act of torture, and I've seen it used to comment on a range of political situations. It was an image used over and over again to say, oh, kids in so-and-so are being tortured by so-and-so. And it doesn't really matter. You just fill in the blanks. But that image is so powerful, and people respond. And this is the problem. We're so quick to respond.
Do you know what's different? There's only one thing different between then and now. Then, media barons with extraordinary influence and wealth had the power to influence people and perceptions. Today, that power has now been transferred to the public.
It's a kind of democratization.
In a way, because also...
So is that a good thing?
In a way, but then it's incumbent upon the reader of that news to, you know, to dissect and sift through what is news and what is not. Don't you think?
Well, I think there's a change in quality. I think, like I said, I think the expert in a previous time would moderate the influence of the media barons. So you would have voices like, say, a Noam Chomsky, right? So yes, the American media system is controlled by certain vested interests, but you always had space for someone like a Noam Chomsky who could, you know, counter that, and people respected those
individuals. But those people still exist.
Well, Noam Chomsky
is certainly still writing.
He does, and I think, and he's probably still one of those great minds who's excluded from the American media landscape. But you're right. I mean, to some extent, I would concede, you know, that it's only a difference in it's not a difference in kind. Maybe just in the intensity.
Last time
maybe.
You had 20 over a bit more, you know, just a few dozen media barons around the world. Now you've got several million or several hundred million people with their idiosyncrasies and prejudices having their opinions known.
Is
it democratization, Sharad?
Yeah, well, look at us, you know, with our opinions.
Look at what we have, right?
Yeah. Anyway, coming up next, we look at the role and the rise of kid influencers. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, It's a Mistake by Men at Work. Kusu Chuang and myself, Sharad Kutin, with you this morning. It is the 24th of October, and it's just a little past 21 minutes past 6 in the morning. You can always join this conversation by WhatsApping us at 018-789-8899, or you can use Twitter, a social media platform.
Twitter.
At BFM Radio.
Do you say Twitter or Twitter?
Twitter,
yes.
I do.
British.
I don't know about that. Okay. You know, apparently, watching toys being taken out of their packaging has become a kind of must-see for toy fans. And I didn't know this.
Yeah, it is. It's massive. Because I've got kids and I live on YouTube, right? And I live on YouTube. They do it less because I limit their use, like, you know what I'm saying? But this is the flip side of what we're talking about, of the democratization of the media, right? Because in the past, you only saw on TV what, you know, the brands are advertising. And it's quite limited in terms of the output. Do you know what I mean, right, Sharad? But today, and this can be quite nefarious in a way, because manufacturers and brands have cottoned on to the fact that children themselves are spending time filming themselves unboxing their toys on YouTube, and the most successful ones are commanding big bucks as what is known as social media influencers. So kids are 7 years old, 8 years old, 9 years old, 12 years old, 15 years old, even in the case of PewDiePie, I think he's in his mid or late 20s by now, they command huge incomes, not just from sharing advertising income from YouTube, but also from brands themselves. And this is what is taking the world by storm.
You know, I think you were right, and we were talking about, you know, control. In some sense, the themes are control and freedom, right, and autonomy. And the more we are democratized, or the more the space and platforms are democratized, the more new forms of control can happen. And I think we are rightly suspicious or concerned about being manipulated. At the same time, the possibilities for kind of niches to develop where people are autonomous and they're they're reviewing each other. They're not just limited to what manufacturers say about their products. The products now are instantly reviewed. That has, really changed the game for everybody. And possibly in positive ways.
It is seen by the end user as more credible than an ad on a paper or on TV, because it is actually being reviewed by an individual that they like to see, or that is well edited or well produced. And I mean, for example, you've got people like Kid Toy Testers, and this is a real channel on YouTube, right? There's five kids from Omaha, the same place that Warren Buffett is from, but obviously this is in kids' toys. They range from 2 years old to 14 years old. 2 years old, right? And they all make videos featuring toys from everyone you can name or think of, including from Mattel, Hasbro, MGA. And it's quite astounding because they've got hundreds of millions of views hundreds of thousands of views per video for the stuff that they produce.
But, you know, the thing is that all these things can also be manipulated.
Once
the next stage of the game is set, somebody is saying, okay, how do I game the situation, right? And how can I use it to my advantage?
Yeah.
And manufacturers have to just be, I mean, they're kind of, I guess, running on the spot in order to keep up or not be left behind more to the point. They need to know how consumers want to, consume their products, how they, where the credibility or the desires come from. And they need to be slightly ahead of the game in order to, catch the next crest.
It's very simple. I mean, remember last year, there was this video on Facebook. This is when Facebook had just newly introduced their Facebook Live, the video platform, right? And there was a housewife from America. She went to a toy store and she put on this Chewbacca mask, right? And it's quite, so she put it on and she was laughing to herself in her car. She filmed herself. She put it on her YouTube, on her Facebook feed. And within days, it went to dozens of millions, hundreds of millions of views. And sales of that Chewbacca mask skyrocketed. And, I think it was Hasbro. They made so much money. They made that Chewbacca mom, or what was she known as, Chewbacca mom, a brand ambassador for them.
Right. So that's serendipity. I mean, nobody could have planned that. It just happened.
But that's why it's so viral now, because it just appears to be so real and credible.
Fascinating. We're coming up to the first bulletin of the day. But before that, we have James Taylor taking us all the way up to Keith Kam, Money Machine. Stay tuned, BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, She's My Baby by the Traveling Wilburys, there with the very distinctive voice of Bob Dylan.
And Roy Orbison, that was the Traveling Wilburys back in the day. Four of them, all big, big names back in the day.
Okay.
I know these
Well, because you do. You're full of knows. Full of knowledge. That's what I meant. Full of knowledge. Okay.
Yes.
Now, speaking of knowledge, the Ministry of Education is getting input from the Malaysian Prisons Department on the possibility, I say possibility, of implementing a rehabilitation program for students with serious disciplinary problems directly in prisons on or in lockups. Now, you might think this, at least on the face of it, seems an ill-conceived program, but it does strike me, think of, you know, the kind of changing fashions when it comes to dealing with problem kids and all that, and juvenile delinquents, of tough love or tough love type programs. So you're citing, you're not just throwing the kids in jail or in a lockup, but, you know, to associate with hardened criminals and therefore learn the life of crime much quicker. It's more like, you know, this would be a salutary lesson to the kids who don't understand the consequences of acting out as they do in school or behaving badly or ignoring their studies might lead them to a life where prison could be a real possibility for them. So it's a kind of tough love approach. It's a kind of let's shock and awe, you know, those kids into going the straight and narrow.
This is all wrong. It's wrong on so many counts. And we haven't learned our mistakes from other countries like, say, America. The reason why kids have become problem kids is because they've come from a social strata which is underprivileged, underaddressed, and underattended, okay? No kid wants to be a juvenile delinquent, nobody, okay? But if you grow up in an underprivileged neighborhood with no food on your table, which is surrounded by criminals and drug addicts, you will probably go that way, and it's the wrong way, unlike the Lenny Kravitz song. So what I'm saying
can the Ministry of Education
they shouldn't
do?
Be sending kids to jail. They should be giving kids like that better access to healthcare, better access to education, better social welfare programs. Jail is the wrong place for kids.
Okay, I'm sympathetic to your position, right? But there's so much the Ministry of Education can do. It can't.
It's not the Ministry of Education's remit. It's the government's remit.
So in the way you posed and framed the question, yes, of course,
nobody wants to be a drug addict, right? Nobody wants to be jacking cars in the middle of the night. Nobody.
Well, I don't know about nobody, but let's put it this way, right? So what can the Ministry of Education do when they have schools, and in those schools there are kids who act out, who are disruptive? What do they do? So we got some numbers here. Apparently, 442 secondary school students have been expelled since January this year. Now, expelling kids is the easiest option for the Ministry of Education because it means they wash their hands of the problem. But if you're going to keep these kids in school, how do you contain them? How do you transform them? How do you support them? You know, recognizing the kinds of things you're talking about, how do you transform their lives so that they become better people, better for themselves, never mind about the rest of society?
Well, I mean, in the UK, you've had boys' homes and certain schools or certain places
institutionalizing kids, right? Take them out and you put juvenile delinquents go into a program, a residential program.
This discussion is being had with the prisons department. Now, why are the authorities talking to the prisons department to send bad kids to the prison? Why would you?
Okay, so
this is not addressing the root of the problem.
Well, look, it hasn't happened yet. They're asking for feedback. Now, what the minister is also saying is that there are various programs. We have one called Remaja Berwawasan, and it's implemented in collaboration with, get it now, the armed forces and the police. Again, it sounds like one of those tough love things. We're going to put you out together with some soldiers who are going to provide you mentorship and maybe even a role model,
some direction.
Right? Yeah, and it is some, I mean, kids who, you know, who perhaps come from, you know, families where they're
to jail, that's okay. I mean, if you give them a certain motive or certain direction in life, that's great, right? But I mean, I certainly, because I've seen enough Hollywood movies to know this, right?
You know, I don't know.
Nobody wants to be a juvie. Nobody. Nobody wants to be on the streets, you know, peddling drugs. Nobody. Nobody wants to be jacking cars. Nobody, right?
Well, I don't know about nobody. I mean, I think what you're saying is that
wouldn't everybody love to have access to good school, good food on the table, good access to healthcare and a nice roof over your heads.
Right? I think
this is society's number one problem now: the gap between the haves and the have-nots.
Absolutely, I agree with you. The question is, how do you address that? Because what you're asking for is nothing short of a social revolution, right?
You narrow the wealth gap. That's what you do.
And what would you do? How would you do it? Who would do it?
We've got more. That is an answer that will take more than 30 seconds, right? You know that.
Okay, we're going to come back and talk about public transport. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, hanging around by Lou Reed. I'm Sherrod Cutton with me, Kusu Chuang. It's the 24th of October, and it's just 15 minutes past 6. And before we get to the top of the hour, when we get the news and all that serious stuff, we have matters of concern. We just talked about tough love and, or how to deal with problematic children. If you have a view, please tweet us at BFM Radio or send us a WhatsApp at 018-789-8899. Thank you, Samuel Tan. He tweeted in, problematic school children need a proper rehab. But the question is, what constitutes proper and effective rehabilitation? And that's a conversation, I think, for educationists and, concerned individuals. So
Policymakers,
yeah. And also teachers who had direct, exposure to kids and know that they're complex psychological things. I mean, you rightly point out, Chuang, to the social context in which these kids grow up that have a determining influence on their behavior. But they're also psychological issues. Issues interpersonal dynamics between parents
from and children. Right? I never saw a rich kid jacking cars at 1 o'clock in the morning.
In Singapore, we had that famous case of Michael Fay.
Rich kids
get into trouble. Some of them steal billions of dollars from, sovereign funds.
That's true.
I mean, let me tell you.
Buy yachts called equanimity.
That's an allegation. And, we'll have to stop there.
I do beg your pardon. Are right, John.
Yeah, because the U.S. Department of Justice is looking out and believe that $250 million from 1MDB was spent to buy Joe Lo's yacht.
Joe Lo, you said his name, Shred. How
yes.
dare you?
It he's innocent. In the news reports.
Don't you know he's innocent?
He probably is. He's from Penang. He must be innocent. Now, let's talk about public transport. It's a big issue. And the Prime Minister has come out to say that, and he was quoting a survey done by the Land Public Transport Commission, or SPAD, that consumer satisfaction is at an all-time high of about 84% of respondents in that survey saying they're satisfied with public transport. And, I must say, somebody who takes public transport, not just out of necessity, but out of conviction, I believe that cities should have good public transport. I must say, things have vastly improved over the last 20 years. It is extraordinary, the transformations.
I must say, in this example, the Prime Minister's wrong. It shouldn't be 84%, it should be 94%. Because the public transport system in Malaysia, as it stands at this point in time, is excellent, right? But as with all surveys, the quality and the accuracy and the credibility of the survey is only as good as the questions that you ask of the respondents. Shouldn't some of the questions in that form be, do you think the government paid the fair price for the public transport system? A. B. Do you think the government was profligate in its payment of public transport infrastructure projects in the past?
Well, it sounds like a variant of the first question. But for users,
did we pay fair price for MRT?
Okay, that's one question. And the other questions, and this would be from a consumer point of view, or a user point of view, is it convenient? Have they solved the last mile problem? Is the price affordable and
which
sustainable?
Which is the last mile issue, which is why the response shouldn't be 100%.
For people like you who have multiple cars and vehicles at home, would you leave them behind and take public transport?
I would. Actually, my house is about a 15-minute walk from the MRT station, and I've done that several times because it's excellent exercise. Right?
Okay.
We've been on this heat, but it's excellent exercise.
Because the new MRT line passes by your home. Yeah, and it takes you all the way to Kajang Satay.
It does, and it's only 7 stops away from Lot 10. Fantastic, fantastic, fantastic service. I'd be the first to admit it, right?
And so, but not just for the odd ride, right? So I think the success of public transport systems is it actually changes the behavior of people in the city opting for public transport and therefore reducing congestion on the road. And that's the real test.
That's the real test. Because in certain stations, for example, the BFM one, right? The nearest stop is the Bandar Utama one, right? So if you worked in BFM, if you wanted to take an MRT to your workplace, you couldn't because it's literally a 50-minute walk from here.
Well, fascinating stuff. Also, thank you, Matthew Baer and Samuel Tan, again, for tweeting in about the question of problematic kids. Matthew said, problem kids need their families. And of course, the Ministry of Education can't make parents love their kids or teach them well. That's something in the realm of a mystery. We're coming up to the 7 o'clock news bulletin. We'll be back with more news and analysis. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9. BFM 89.9, Kusu Chuang and myself, Asharad Kutin, continuing our conversations about the media and our attitudes towards it. Apparently, a marketing research company has done a survey of some 70,000 people across 56 countries and conducted, dozens of in-depth interviews to get a sense of what it is to live the connected life. And one of the findings is that Malaysians spend an average of 7.2 hours a day online, and yet they generally mistrust online content. So they have this rather contradictory, kind of impulses. We spoke to MC Lai, the managing director of Kantar TNS Malaysia. We asked him to tell us more about the underlying factors behind Malaysians' general skepticism towards online content.
So I think from our study, we see that compared to some of our neighbors around Southeast Asia, Malaysians generally the distrust factor is higher. I think that's very much driven by the discernment of the consumers right now. So I think if you sort of look at what's happening, we have got quite a few organizations and parties trying to educate Malaysian consumers of don't believe everything you see and don't believe everything you read. So I think that helps. And then I think second of all, Malaysian has always been one of the highest in terms of online usage. And I think in that sense, we're ahead. So therefore, Malaysian have also started to use a lot more ad blockers and so on and so forth. So I think in that sense, we are quite ahead or developed in this context compared to our neighbors.
So we're trying to get behind this. Is it because we are much more savvy in our use of the internet that we're also less trusting?
Correct. And I think on top of it, with the development of all these technologies right now, it really enable consumers like Malaysians to pick and choose what they want and filter out what they don't, which is, again, a good or bad thing depending on where you're coming from. As a brand, I think that's going to be some challenge in terms of, therefore, how do we need to engage the consumer better?
So finally, we asked him, how brands and manufacturers and marketers do better considering this is the general disposition of Malaysians and the landscape here.
I think with brands or marketers right now, I think that has also developed quite a bit. So 3-4 years ago, it was more about whatever that we have on TV, let's just put it on Facebook, put it on Instagram, and that should work. But right now, given the development and then involvement of various social media platforms, marketers need to understand that, depending on the various moments that we want to connect with the consumers, we need to think about the platform, therefore the content. And it's no longer just anything and everything that we put consumer would want to read. So it has to be something that is creative. That's one of the key factors to create the kind of engagement. It has to be short, simple, and leaving a very lasting impression. So therefore, in a way, it's a push or a challenge back to the creative out there that, we really need to put something that has that kind of value to consumer and not just any information.
That was MC Lai, Managing Director of Kantar TNS of Malaysia, that conducted a survey on the connected life, and they did that across over 56 countries, and we brought you some of the results from the Malaysian segment of that survey. I mean, what's your general opinion about this, Chuang? I mean, in terms of skepticism and savviness, I mean, do you yourself, engage in ad blockers? I mean, ad blockers sounds like something that might make you thinner.
Well, the reason why Malaysians are so adept in sifting out the truth from the chaff, or the wheat from the chaff, is because we've had so much practice through the years. And that's the primary reason why we're so good at it. We've been able to read through between the lines for decades, and because we've had lots of practice.
Well, okay, so that's a kind of backhanded compliment, right? Saying that because
I don't think that was a lack of transparency,
because there's a lot of double speak, because of the elliptical nature of political leaders in how they relate
political
to
political ownership of the mainstream media
and political ownership of the mainstream. So the,
say it for what
propaganda,
it is.
Mm-hmm. All these things make us, not kind of thoughtless robots and who just consume whatever's given to us. In fact, it's made us much more sophisticated. So the deep irony of the situation is that we are savvier, more skeptical, more critical potentially than people who are much more democratic and open society.
That's true. I mean, as human beings, I think generally, naturally, our BS gauge is actually quite well developed. But on the internet, on the written word, it's much less developed in other societies. But in Malaysia, that is the thing. Is that's only one initial preliminary step. You've also got to act on it and activate it, right? So I think with the internet space, you are being, because it's a two-way street, it's a lot of interaction. You may not believe what you write in the past, but you, unless you wrote a letter to the editor and got printed in the middle pages of the Star, you were not able to voice your dissent, but now you can. And I think that's another way the internet has really shaken the mainstream.
But if you look at the quality of that dissent, you also see some of the downside people weaned on open media. So, for instance, our tendency to impute conspiracy to everything, right? So conspiracy theorists are a dime a dozen in this country. Everybody, it seems, is a conspiracy theorist because they're so skeptical that they can never suspend that skepticism and believe in something. So what could be good, in a sense, as a defense mechanism against propaganda and the manipulation of the media and information, is also the inability to then step back and think in a positive and programmatic way about the world around you. And so, there's so much vitriol and anger also if you look at that, interactivity.
Right, you're right. But, even Los Angeles was the Wild Wild West back in the day, 200 years ago, right, with gunslinging cowboys. But it's a time process, and over the next couple hundred years, they became a metropolis, and people grew up, and they realized what was art and what was not. So the internet today is like the Wild Wild West in a way, because it's essentially only been, 20 years since Netscape first arrived with their Navigator browser, and 20 years is nothing but a pimple on the annals of time, right? So over time, over the next few decades, we'll get to a certain point where the internet will grow up and the feedback loop will improve and credibility will rise.
Yeah, that may be. I do think that, there is a problem here, though, in terms of public discourse. So you say the internet learns, and of course, that's a global thing. It's not a Malaysian thing. It's a global thing.
If you go to the Financial Times and you see the responses to a particular story written by, for example, anyone, right? Say, for example, John Authors. He writes the weekend markets wrap-up. And the kind of responses that you get from the readers of the Financial Times is a great deal removed from responses to, for example, Sina Harian, for example, because of the backgrounds and the profiles of the people who read it. So it depends on what kind of feedback you get.
Fascinating. We're going to come back with more, but if you have and want to join this conversation, you can always tweet us at BFM Radio. You can join us on WhatsApp 018-789-8899. Tell Chuang what you really think. Stay tuned. BFM 89.9.
Thank you for listening to this podcast. To find more great interviews, go to bfm.my or find us on iTunes. BFM 89.9, the business station.